Welcome to the March 7th, 2024 episode of Blood Podcast, your source for innovative ideas and cutting-edge information. Our topics are based on articles published in Blood, a journal of the American Society of Hematology. First on today's podcast, Part 2 Biased Signaling in Thromboinflammation. In a model of pulmonary viral infection, macrophage infiltration was mediated through biased signaling of protease-activated receptor 2, or PAR2, initiated by the factor 7a tissue factor complex. The findings suggest a potential for therapies that target factor 7a tissue factor signaling. Up next, hemoglobin levels are linked to survival in transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. In a large patient cohort, researchers report an association between ascending pre-transfusion hemoglobin starting at 9.5 grams per deciliter and reduced risk of mortality. Finally, etoposide is better than its reputation in primary HLH, hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. Symptomatic patients treated with etoposide have substantially better outcomes as compared to the historical experience. It's a new benchmark against which novel treatment regimens should be evaluated. Let's start with our first research article. Nucleic acid sensing promotes inflammatory monocyte migration through biased coagulation factor 7a signaling. The first author is Hortensia Zelaya of Johannes Gutenberg University Medical Center in Mainz, Germany, and colleagues. Coagulation activation by the tissue factor, or TF, pathway is a hallmark of severe acute bacterial and viral infections. The tissue factor pathway is also thought to play a key role in mediating an effective innate immune response to these same infections. Here, the authors use a mouse model to learn how macrophages are induced to migrate into the lung after exposure to the synthetic viral RNA, poly-IC. The tissue factor, factor 7a complexes, are known to induce signaling in macrophages by binding to and cleaving protease-activated receptors, particularly PAR2. The PARs and G-protein-coupled receptors that mediate biased signaling, meaning that the same receptor can activate different downstream signaling pathways in response to different ligands or in different cellular contexts. In particular, PAR2 can signal through either G-proteins or beta-arrestin. Tissue factor complexed with factor 7a can activate PAR2 in one of two ways. In one pathway, which requires expression of endothelial protein C receptor, PAR2 activation is mediated by factor 10a. In a second pathway, the tissue factor factor 7a complex activates PAR2 independently of factor 10a, but requires integrins. In the first set of experiments, investigators asked whether the activating protease was factor 7a or factor 10a. By exposing mice with factor deletions or deficiencies to a poly-IC challenge, they determined that factor 7a was required for inflammatory cell recruitment to the alveolar space. By contrast, factor 10 was not essential for this process. Subsequently, they found cleavage of PAR2 was required for recruitment of monocytes and macrophages into the lungs. Mice expressing a PAR2 mutant resistance to cleavage by all proteases, including factor 7a, were protected from lung inflammation after poly-IC. By contrast, factor 10a resistant PAR2 mutant mice were not protected. This suggests inflammatory cell recruitment specifically requires activation of PAR2 independent of factor 10a. The researchers also identified the downstream signaling pathway regulated by the tissue factor factor 7a PAR signaling complex. Migration of monocytes and macrophages stimulated by poly-IC was dependent on activation of ERK and mitochondrial antiviral signaling. By contrast, migration was shown to be independent of toll-like receptor 3. In further experiments, they utilized a monoclonal antibody that blocks tissue factor factor 7a signaling, but does not interfere with prothrombotic function. By inhibiting tissue factor factor 7a signaling, they blocked macrophage migration on fibrinogen layers following poly-IC challenge. Interestingly, the antibody had minimal effects on interferon secretion in response to poly-IC. Authors also generated PAR mutant mice that were deficient in beta-arrestin recruitment and ERK scaffolding. Using these mice, they demonstrated that PAR2 beta-arrestin signaling was required to drive monocyte macrophage recruitment to the lungs following poly-IC challenge. Authors say their results identify tissue factor factor 7a part 2 biased signaling through arrestin-ERK MAP kinase coupling as a central mechanism for immune cell recruitment due to lung inflammation in this model. Modulating this signal axis could be a promising target for treating viral infections. In a commentary, Marvin T. Nyman of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, describes this work as a long journey through multiple mutant mice that meticulously demonstrates the in vivo consequences of PAR2 bias signaling through tissue factor factor 7a activation. The tools used in this study, he adds, provide a roadmap for defining cell-specific biased signaling pathways in the complex environment in vivo. In particular, gene editing facilitates introduction of cleavage-resistant mutations into mice, allowing for in vivo assessments needed to understand protease-mediated signaling. Going forward, Nyman concludes, it will be important to consider how proteases mediate specific signaling in other disease models and tissues. Next up, a letter to blood. Pre-transfusion hemoglobin level and mortality in adults with transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. The first author is Khaled M. Musallam of Burjil Medical City, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. We know that many patients with thalassemia will need regular transfusions due to severe anemia. Before regular transfusion therapy, roughly half of thalassemia major patients died before the age of 10. And today, with regular transfusions and careful management of iron overload, patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia can survive into their 70s with excellent quality of life. But what is the optimal hemoglobin concentration that should trigger transfusion? Recommendations have varied. Over the past few decades, target ranges of 9 to 10, 9 to 10.5, and 9.5 to 10.5 grams per deciliter have been published in various guidelines. These were based on expert opinion, informed by data on the association between pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels and suppression of erythropoiesis. By contrast, there are few data on the linkage between pre-transfusion hemoglobin level and mortality risk. In one recent analysis of patients with non-transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia, a hemoglobin level of 10 or lower was independently associated with a 7.6-fold increased mortality risk. That finding suggests a need to revisit the relationship between hemoglobin and mortality in transfusion-dependent patients as well. Accordingly, Musallam et al. Have evaluated the linkage between pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels and mortality in a large cohort of patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia. The retrospective cohort study was based on electronic medical records for adult patients who were being followed at 5 treatment centers in Italy between January 2010 and December 2019. All patients had received an average of at least 10 red blood cell units per year. The patients were organized into 5 categories according to their average pre-transfusion hemoglobin level over the 10-year observation period. The lowest hemoglobin category was below 9, increasing in 0.5 grams per deciliter increments until the highest category, which was 10.5 or higher. The analysis includes 779 patients, most of whom were followed for the full 10 years, except for 24 who died due to thalassemia, 2 who died due to accidents, and 16 who transferred or lost to follow-up. The median age at the start of the study was approximately 33 years. About 51% of the patients were female, and nearly 40% were splenectomized. The median serum ferritin level was 1195.3 nanograms per milliliter, and median pre-transfusion hemoglobin level was 9.7 grams per deciliter over the observation period. The pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels were fairly stable over time, as indicated by a median standard deviation of just 0.17 grams per deciliter. The results indicate a significant stepwise decrease in mortality with ascending pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels. The thalassemia-related mortality rate ranged from 9.3% for patients with pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels below 9 to 0% for pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels of 10.5 or higher. That translated into 5 and 10-year survival rates of 93% and 91% in that lowest hemoglobin category, below 9. And 5 and 10-year survival rates of 100% in the highest category, 10.5 and above. The best predictor of elevated thalassemia-related mortality was pre-transfusion hemoglobin level below a threshold of 9.3 grams per deciliter. And in a multivariate Cox regression model, using less than 9 grams per deciliter as the reference, the effect of higher hemoglobin on mortality was significant starting at 9.5 grams per deciliter and above. Results were largely unchanged when adjusting for potential confounders such as age, sex, and splenectomy. Stratified by serum ferritin levels, the association with hemoglobin level was only significant for ferritin of less than 1,000 nanograms per milliliter, consistent with an effect of anemia on survival separate from that of iron overload. Authors say their work establishes an association between higher pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels and lower thalassemia-related mortality in adults with transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. Based on this finding, the pre-transfusion hemoglobin target range of 9.5 to 10.5 grams per deciliter in the 2021 guidelines from the Thalassemia International Federation seems reasonable, they add. However, the argument could be made for levels greater than 10.5 grams per deciliter, depending on factors such as blood product availability and transfusion frequency. So, based on this work, one can say higher hemoglobin is better in thalassemia. That's the title of a commentary by Thomas D. Coates of the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Coates says the authors have submitted a landmark paper that calls attention to the effects of small increases in hemoglobin. Survival was measurably better in patients whose pre-transfusion hemoglobin levels are maintained above 10.5 grams per deciliter, and 10.5 is at the upper end of the currently recommended range. Targeting hemoglobin to 9.5 to 10.5, if not greater than 10.5, would be a big departure from practice at many centers. But transfusing to higher levels seems to improve survival in thalassemia. Coates concludes that the old recommendations for transfusion in thalassemia were adequate, but now we know that 10.5 is measurably better. Our final article is Survival in Primary Hemophagocytic Lymphohistiocytosis, 2016 to 2021. Etoposide is better than its reputation. And the first author is Svea Baum of University Medical Center Eppendorf in Hamburg, Germany. As background, we know HLH as a syndrome characterized by excessive inflammation. HLH is considered either primary or secondary. Primary when it's caused by inherited genetic defects, and secondary when it develops in response to a strong immunological stimulus. There are a number of genetic defects which predispose to HLH, including loss-of-function mutations in the genes encoding perforin, or molecules involved in the secretion of perforin-containing cytotoxic granules. HLH is also a common manifestation of Griscelli syndrome type 2, or Chidiak-Higashi syndrome. Other associations include X-linked lymphoproliferative syndromes or inherited disorders of susceptibility to Epstein-Barr virus. Primary HLH, the focus of this research article, has been most often treated with etoposide, typically with dexamethasone. And the only proven curative approach is stem cell transplantation. There are two landmark studies, known as HLH-94 and HLH-2004, that support the use of etoposide-based therapy and dexamethasone, followed by allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplant. Those studies yielded 5-year overall survival rates of 50% and 59%, respectively. But now it's 2024, so these studies don't necessarily provide us with contemporary data on the standard of care. That's a challenge because novel approaches are being investigated in primary HLH. These novel clinical trials include studies of first-line anti-CD52 monoclonal antibody, alemtuzumab, and salvage therapy with the anti-interferon gamma-blocking antibody, emapalumab, that have been completed. And there are ongoing studies of ruxolitinib used alone or in combination with etoposide. Where should these studies fit into HLH treatment recommendations? That's hard to say without a current benchmark. To fill this gap, Baum et al. Evaluated aggregate outcomes for patients with primary HLH documented in registries between 2016 and 2021. And according to authors, the results were better than they anticipated. The study included a total of 88 patients with primary HLH, including 76 who were symptomatic, and 12 in whom the diagnosis was made based on index siblings or partial albinism. Of the symptomatic patients, 86% received first-line etoposide, though other treatments included ATG, alemtuzumab, emapalumab, and ruxolitinib, and 75% of patients underwent stem cell transplantation. Now, for survival results. For the entire cohort of 88 patients, including the asymptomatic ones, the overall 3-year probability of survival was approximately 82%. For the symptomatic patients who received first-line etoposide, 91% survived to transplantation, and 85% survived post-transplantation, with a 3-year overall survival of 77%. Looking specifically at patients who underwent transplantation, 3-year overall survival after transplant was 88%. Asymptomatic patients fared quite well, with a survival rate of 100% in those who underwent early hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. In a commentary on these findings, authors say these results show that, quote, old is gold when it comes to frontline etoposide for primary HLH. Authors of that commentary are Nitya Guladi of Weill Cornell Medical College in New York and Michelle L. Hermiston of the University of California, San Francisco. In their commentary, Guladi and Hermiston say this study provides a new benchmark to which novel and often more expensive treatment regimens should be compared. They say one key finding of the study is that the early transplantation of asymptomatic patients results in excellent survival. That emphasizes the benefit of newborn screening. But the crucial finding, they add, is that contemporary outcomes are much better than in the historical HLH-94 and 2004 studies, particularly for those patients who received etoposide as first-line therapy. What drove the improvements in outcome is not addressed in the study, but it could be that earlier diagnosis, better supportive care, and shorter time to transplant play a role. For example, time to transplant in this contemporary cohort was 88 days, as compared to 148 days in the HLH-2004 study. Improved regimens for salvage could also have played a role in improving outcomes. However, the improvements are likely not all attributable to better disease control. Of note, the approach to HSCT has changed over time in primary HLH. The HLH-2004 study included traditional, fully myeloablative conditioning regimens. By contrast, most patients in the current study received reduced toxicity myeloablative and reduced intensity conditioning, which are associated with low rates of treatment-related toxicity and early mortality. So the improved survival in this study, Guladi and Hermiston say, may be due to these transplant-related improvements, along with better supportive care, especially since there were no substantial differences between the current and historical cohorts in terms of pre-transplant complete response rates or need for salvage therapy. It's important to acknowledge the limitations of this contemporary analysis. It's retrospective, and 70% of the patients were from Germany and Switzerland, so the survival improvements may be due to enhanced care at specific sites in those countries. And the study is not powered to address whether etoposide is superior to other frontline approaches. However, the commentary authors conclude, the study does highlight the need for studies evaluating new agents that are potentially more active in primary HLH and cost-effective, and comparing them to the results from this study, which sets the new standard. You have been listening to the Blood Podcast. For a list of additional authors, as well as more detailed articles and commentaries on which this podcast is based, please go to bloodjournal.org. Be sure to join us next week for another episode. Thank you for listening.